From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, dramatic near-death stories. Here's what's happening. Governors in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware have a lot to consider before fully reopening. If they open too quickly, that could result in more deaths, they say, according to a new model from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, if you believe that study. Reopening states' economy certainly comes with a cost, they say, that could result in more deaths. Here's a strange story. A University of Pittsburgh professor on the verge of making very significant findings researching COVID-19, according to the university, has been shot and killed in an apparent murder-suicide over the weekend. The research assistant professor identified as Bing Liu was found in his townhouse Saturday with gunshot wounds to the head, neck, torso, and extremities. Investigators believe an unidentified second man who was found dead in his car shot and killed Liu in his home before returning to his car and taking his own life. Police believe the men knew each other, but they say there's no indication there was targeting due to him being Chinese. Well, as we were talking about 5G yesterday with guest Ben Stewart, there have always been long-standing concerns about the radio waves that are being emitted by our devices, especially our cell phones. However, it seems that these concerns have been amplified with the launch of 5G, where there have been a lot of theories that are linking 5G to various health issues, so much so that some people are actually actively taking matters into their own hands, where, according to reports, a small town in Quebec, Canada, has experienced an incident where several cell phone towers have been set on fire over allegations that 5G is somehow linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour, author of Pandemic, and get his take on the latest. Gary, what's your thoughts on what's happening so far?
Well, first off, I want to mention that murder hornets is a hoax. You're seeing it all over the place. There are no murder hornets on the way, period.
Let's hope not.
My take on the whole thing, though, is that the death rates are climbing, and it looks like social isolation and masks from 1918 are not working. Cuomo just came up with something, and I didn't understand it. He said something to the effect that 60% of the people that they had coronavirus came from home.
Jeez.
And they're telling us all to stay home, for God's sakes.
I don't think they know what they're doing, Gary. I really don't.
This is a total bust. The thing we do know is that the airlines are going to shrink to nothing. There's going to be mass bankruptcies. The oil industry is already tanked. And then yesterday I went to Walmart and there was no beef products there.
Now, here's another concern, too, Gary. I'm told by some doctors that they're basically being pushed to put most deaths down as coronavirus.
That is part of the billing problem in America. When you bill something, you try to put the expensive diagnosis down so you get better reimbursement.
Really?
So throwing coronavirus in, you get a better reimbursement for that one and also all the funds that you put into trying to save this person.
Reimbursed by whom? Government?
Yeah, insurance companies, Medicare, so on and so forth. You just, you know, you're signed up with them. You see the hospital. It's the hospital, actually. The hospital sends in the bill with all these things that they billed out. And then what's the diagnosis of? Respiratory failure due to coronavirus.
All right, we'll talk to you.
Just normal pneumonia.
We'll talk to you next week, Gary. Thank you so much. Kim Jong-un disappeared from public view over the past few weeks because of concerns about the coronavirus, not for any heart-related surgery, according to South Korea's intelligence agency. The disclosure comes after members of South Korea's parliament were briefed by the country's National Intelligence Service. According to Reuters, Kim made his first public appearance in nearly 3 weeks last Friday at a fertilizer factory near the North Korean capital. Private payrolls hemorrhaged more than 20 million jobs in April as companies sliced workers amid a coronavirus-induced shutdown that took most of the U.S. economy offline, according to a report Wednesday from the ADP. In all, the decline totaled 20,236,000, easily the worst loss in the survey's history, going way back to 2002. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us. John, we got to open up pretty soon.
Well, we've been saying this for a while right now, and I think these states right now, to be honest about it, are waiting for a federal bailout. I think stage three, number three, major trillion-plus dollar bailout is going to be designed for cities and states because New York is bankrupt, California is rapidly becoming bankrupt right now. I mean, these are two fairly large states. I think Trump, has got his finger on something. All these blue states, basically, creating like these welfare states where people are have more money coming in to stay at home right now than they do going back. There's more incentive to stay at home and collect unemployment than the extra benefits from these bailouts than going back to work. But I think, the government and the government alone in the management of this has proven to be a complete disaster. The idea that shelter in place, this is something that's been pushed, as you know, by the medical experts, the epidemiologists that are working on that White House task force, Andrew Fauci and Deborah Birx, have been saying you got to shut everything down in order to, slow this virus. And it's turning out that most people who are hospitalized right now in the New York area were sheltering in place before they were hospitalized. And Cuomo was dumbfounded today reporting this data. But I think what it is the government doesn't know what they're doing. They'd better get people back to work quickly because the GDP of this country, the unemployment rate right now is at depression levels. We're talking about 30% in major cities right now unemployed and climbing every day. The new numbers from ADP and the Labor Department coming out on Friday are going to be an absolute disaster. And I think you're looking more stock market roller coastering is going to go on as, the way that the effect that the economy is not going to snap back from this. It's going to take months, if not years, to recover from this. And the fact that a lot of people right now would prefer to stay home and collect the benefits rather than return to work is a real problem, George.
It sure is. And people are at a breaking point two ways, economically and emotionally right now. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, listen to this one. For the first time in history, it may be absolutely accurate to say that the passenger car, once the bread and butter of the automobile industry, is unpopular. In April, more buyers purchased trucks than passenger cars for the first time ever in U.S. history. A previously unseen asteroid the size of a truck flew about 4,300 miles over the Pacific Ocean on Monday, making it one of the closest passes by our planet on record. That is close. Up next, political operative Roger Stone joins us. He's been sentenced to 40 months in jail. His gag order has been lifted, and he's ready to talk and say everything he can. Roger Stone, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We have a very special guest for you tonight for the first couple hours. Roger Stone back with us. I've been waiting for this date for a long time. He's been under a gag order for some time now, 16 months. It's finally been lifted. Roger, of course, is a political consultant, lobbyist, author. A couple of his books include Stone's Rules and Jeb and the Bush Crime Family. And he was, of course, pulled in to the Mueller report investigation, convicted on 7 counts, including witness tampering and, they say, lying to investigators. He has been sentenced to 40 months in federal prison. That's about to begin, and we're going to be talking with Roger about all this. The gag order has been lifted. Roger, before we get started, how are you and your family? How are you weathering all this?
Well, we're doing extraordinarily well, considering. I mean, first of all, how about the concept of a gag order, that a defendant in a criminal case loses their right to defend themselves? That's not only unconstitutional, it's un-American. In my particular case, the judge reasoned that if I were allowed to speak on, say, shows like Coast to Coast or to post on my social media, I would taint the jury, which makes no sense at all. No. Because The Washington Post and CNN were pounding on me every day for 2 years. Were they tainting the jury? judge offered no evidence or proof of this. It was a theory. Actually, it's kind of weird. If you go to Google Trends, the only time people looking up my name spike is when the judge attacks me from the bench. So if anybody was tainting the jury, I guess it would be her. As you point out, I have been tightly silenced for 16 months. Roger Stone, who can't talk, is like Usain Bolt that can't run. And I'm really grateful to you, George, to have the opportunity to tell my side of the story. Anybody who will look at my case objectively will realize that I have been the target of a political prosecution, and I am the last victim of the Mueller witch hunt. When I was charged, I said I would be exonerated, but I believed I would have a fair trial. And as I outlined, there was nothing about my trial that was fair. There was nothing about my jury that was impartial and indifferent as required by the law. So let's start at the beginning.
And let's tell people, Raj, also just what this was all about in the beginning. You know, the WikiLeaks, the emails.
Exactly.
So, yeah, go ahead.
During the 2016 campaign, both from public sources and from a tip, a guy named Randy Credico, who is a progressive radio host and a comic impressionist, I heard that the WikiLeaks disclosures of material that they had obtained regarding Hillary was explosive, and I heard that it would be released in October. I teased that on my Twitter feed, not to aggrandize myself, not to be important, but to make sure the mainstream media could not sweep it under the rug when it happened. There has never been any evidence whatsoever that I knew the content or the source of the material. I had a tip, and I rode that tip very hard. In about 2018, there began a series of stories that were leaked to CNN, MSNBC, that various associates of mine, friends of mine, former associates of mine, were being dragged in front of the grand jury. And, of course, they were wanted to know whether I was the link between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks, which I most definitely was not, or if I had some connection to the Russians, which I most definitely did not. In fact, I later learned that Robert Mueller's dirty cops went to a federal judge and a magistrate and told them they had probable cause to investigate me for treason, conspiracy against the United States, violation of the foreign contribution ban, fraud and related activities in connection with computers, wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering, aiding and abetting a felony, unauthorized access of a protected computer, and accessory after the fact to a felony. After a proctological examination of every square inch of my life, all my emails, all my text messages, all of my phone calls for at least 2 years, Mueller and his dirty cops found no evidence whatsoever of any of those crimes. It was then that I was charged with lying to Congress. Really? Lying to Congress? You mean like General Clapper or John Brennan, Hillary Clinton, James Comey, McCabe? This list goes on and on. There's a difference, though. Those people lied about significant things, important things. Clapper, for example, lied about whether we were tracking American citizens by collecting metadata.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I argue that when I went to the House Intelligence Committee, first of all, I went voluntarily. I wasn't compelled. I testified for 4 hours, and any misstatement I made was immaterial. In other words, there was no underlying crime for me to lie about. So what actually happened here was that Robert Mueller and his prosecutors, a fellow, the people who prosecuted me become kind of key to the story, essentially colluded with Adam Schiff and set up a series of gotcha questions, none of which were particularly important. For example, did you get an email from Steve Bannon on August 2nd? I don't remember. Aha, you did. Yes, but it's a discussion of a story in that morning's Washington Post. No secret.
And Hedsey would say, you lied.
You lied. You lied. You lied. Now, so to violate the False Statement Act, first of all, you have to have intent. And secondarily, you have to have motive. I had no crime to cover up. In the end, I was convicted of lying about the Trump campaign's interest in the WikiLeaks disclosures, which candidate Donald Trump himself announced on 142 occasions in September and October. There was never anything to hide. The witness tampering charge is an absurdity. The witness, Randy Credico, who I'm accused of threatening, said on the stand and in a letter to a judge that he never felt threatened. But the grand jury did have evidence that he sent an email to another grand jury witness, an exculpatory witness, threatening to put a hole in his head. He was not charged with witness tampering. Anyway, after this exhaustive investigation, as I think most Americans know, on the morning of January 25th, 2019, in the pre-dawn hours, my home was raided by 29 SWAT-clad assault rifle carrying FBI agents.
I was on the air that night, Roger, watching CNN when that was happening.
They arrived in 17 armored vehicles. They brought a giant battering ram up to my front door as if I wasn't going to answer the door. They had these really fierce-looking dogs, a canine unit, on leashes. There's a helicopter overhead.
Jeez.
I lived on a canal at that time, and there were two amphibious units with frogmen who were also armed. They completely surrounded the house, and they banged on the door and said, FBI, open the door. I did. They said, are you Roger Stone? I said, I am. They said, we have a warrant for your arrest, and we have a warrant to search these premises. Please put your hands behind your back. Now, let's be clear. I have no previous criminal record. I'm charged with white-collar process crimes. I do not have a valid passport. I don't own a firearm, even though I am a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. And thanks to the beating I took for a year, Mueller closing in on Stone, Mueller focused on Stone, everybody in America knows what I look like. So the claim that I had to be arrested in this over-the-top Gestapo manner because I was a flight risk was completely disproved 3 hours later when the government didn't ask for a cash bond for my release. I was never a flight risk. But even more outrageous, as you point out, CNN was allowed to film the entire scene. They had a tripod 25 feet from my front door. Now, I know now, from looking at the security camera footage, that CNN showed up exactly 14 minutes before the FBI, and they say it was just a hunch.
No hunch. When you bring a live camera and remote unit, you've got hours of time to prepare for it. Somebody tipped them off, Raj.
No question about it. Now, to this day, FBI Director Christopher Wray refuses to hand over emails between CNN and the FBI in the days and weeks prior to my arrest, even though the law requires it. Right now, Judicial Watch is suing to get that material. I was frog marched out in front of the house barefoot, and I was wearing a Roger Stone Did Nothing Wrong t-shirt that I had put on that morning. My wife, who is hearing impaired, woke up looking down the barrel of guns. She, too, was marched out in the middle of the street in her bare feet.
Oh, geez.
I live on a dead-end street. I now know that the street had been sealed, and therefore the only media unit allowed in for this show was CNN. Looking at the camera security footage, I know that the FBI agents spoke to the camera crew several times. So I would like to know who ordered this raid, because my lawyers had spoken to the special counsel's office the day before.
And you still don't know?
We still don't know, meaning they know I was represented. If they had contacted my lawyer, I simply could have turned myself in, which is what the normal course is in cases like this, and saved the taxpayers, I hope you're sitting down, $1.1 million.
My God.
For this extravaganza. Senator Lindsey Graham wrote a hot letter to the FBI demanding to know who approved this raid. Of course, he never got an answer, and he never followed up.
Roger, stay right there. We're going to take a break, but we will come right back, and we're going to keep you next hour as well to talk about the story. We might even try to get some phone calls in from our listeners. But we have much more to talk about with Roger Stone about his situation. Politics is a rough game, and I also want you to think about what would you do if you were running an election and you had the ability to get emails about your opponent that you could use to help win? Would you use it? We'll be back with Roger Stone in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, Roger Stone. We are talking about his personal situation now. He's been sentenced to 40 months in jail. Let's see what happens with that. Will the president pardon him? We'll get Roger's reaction to that. But let's get more of the story because, for really the first time, he's been under a gag order for 16 months. This is his opportunity to tell us his side of the story, what he believes happened. One of the questions I'm going to ask him when we come back right after the break here is, what's wrong with getting emails about your opponent? Is that against the law? I don't know. We'll be back in a moment with Roger Stone on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Roger Stone. Roger, let me ask you this before we get into the rest of your story. If I were running for president, I'd want to talk with Putin from Russia, Khomeini of Iran, and as many political leaders as I could to get them to understand where I'm coming from and maybe get them to support my platform. Is there anything wrong with that?
I don't believe so. I actually always think that it is better to talk to your enemies than to launch thermonuclear missiles at them. But the question you asked before the break, is it illegal to receive emails about your opponent? In my case, it's an academic question. There was never any evidence whatsoever that I received anything from WikiLeaks or Julian Assange or the Russians or any other source. I was essentially convicted of lying about banter with other people in the campaign, speculating about what was to come. That's how ridiculous these charges are. I was arrested at 6 a.m. At 7 a.m., the special counsel's office email blasted a copy of my indictment to the entire media, and they put it up on their website. The problem with that is it wasn't unsealed by a magistrate until 9:30. So they violated the law. By the way, they also left the metadata tags on the document, so I know the notorious Andrew Weissman wrote my indictment. My indictment is a confection, to say the least. At the time, I pled not guilty because I thought I would have a fair trial. Then Robert Mueller used a clever piece of legal trickery to ensure that rather than having a random selection of the judge, they claimed my case was related to a case he has brought against, I think it's 16 Russians, who he alleges hacked the DNC. There's never been any discovery in that case. They've never presented any evidence in that case. That case has nothing to do with me, but it ensured that my case would be heard by Amy Berman Jackson, an Obama appointee, the judge who dismissed the wrongful death suit against Hillary Clinton by the Benghazi families, the judge who ruled that tax dollars can be used for abortion, the judge who incarcerated Paul Manafort prior to his being convicted of any crime. Judge Jackson is a partisan. She would go on to violate my First, Fourth, and Sixth Amendment rights. But more precisely, she would essentially eliminate every powerful line of defense. I'll give you an example. But the underlying premise of my indictment is that the Russians hacked the DNC and gave the information to WikiLeaks. I was prohibited from proving in court with forensic evidence and experts like Bill Binney, the former technical director of the NSA for Russian affairs, that never happened. There is no evidence to support that claim. In fact, the forensic evidence would indicate that the stolen material was downloaded internally to a portable drive and taken out the back door. But I couldn't raise that question. How about selective prosecution? You have Comey, Brennan, McCabe, Clapper, Orr, Rosenstein, Mueller himself, all lying to Congress, but none of them prosecuted. No, Judge Jackson ruled that I could not pursue that line of defense. How about the misconduct of the FBI, the DOJ, the special counsel's office? As I will tell you later, they broke a lot of laws. Or any member of Congress. No, I was prohibited from raising the question of their misconduct. Because we got the FBI to admit in discovery that they never inspected the servers at the Democratic National Committee, that they relied on a draft redacted report from an IT firm called CrowdStrike, funded by a couple of Hillary Clinton's supporters. When I began to talk about that, the judge tightened the gag order on me. Good God, we can't let Stone tell the American people the truth. The Steele dossier had crumbled. The entire Russian narrative was falling apart. Now I was challenging the Russians hacked the DNC theory, which to this day is incorrect. Not only that, but let's take a look at the prosecutors. Leading my prosecution team, Jeannie Rhee, former personal lawyer for Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, the lawyer who represented them in the missing emails case. By the way, the same lawyer who lied to the judge in that case, claiming that all the material had been turned over to the court when it happened, when it hadn't. Aaron Zelinsky, this guy's a real piece of work, a bully, a pompous ass, who liked to threaten people, threatened my lawyers a couple times. This guy was deputy counsel to Hillary Clinton at the State Department. And then at trial, a guy named Jonathan Kravis. The media kept describing him as a career line prosecutor. In fact, he was the deputy counsel to Barack Obama in the White House. These are political operatives. The idea that my prosecutors were biased violates the Constitution. I'm entitled to an unbiased prosecutor, to an honest prosecutor. I was prosecuted by Hillary Clinton's operatives. Why? Because I wrote the book, The Clinton's War on Women, because Donald Trump used it to great effect in 2016. It is still, to this day, the definitive work on the epic corruption of Bill, Hillary, and their daughter, not their daughter, pardon me, her daughter, Chelsea. So I was victimized by these people. They didn't allow me any lines of defense. And you might wonder, what was this all really about? On July 24th, 2019, we found out. That's when the prosecutors approached my lawyers to propose a quote-unquote deal. If your client was willing to fess up and tell the truth about 30 phone calls between him and candidate Trump in 2016, all of which lasted more than 30 minutes, well, we might be willing to recommend no jail time. In other words, they wanted me to lie. They wanted
Donald Trump, didn't they?
Right. That's what this was always about. It wasn't about Roger Stone, but I have a 40-year history with Donald Trump. I wanted him to run for president since 1988.
Were you surprised when he won, Raj?
No, I really was not. I actually knew the Saturday before that he was going to win because I had access to some of the large state Republican Party polling. Donald Trump would never pay for polling, so the campaign had no polling, but I could see the trend line.
Uh-huh.
Look, he completely outworked and outfoxed Hillary Clinton.
Well, he did.
She spent in excess of $2 billion. He spent about $375 million all told. That's independent plus his campaign. He just ran a better campaign, and they never expected that they would lose. Therefore, they never expected that their emails would be examined. The prosecutorial misconduct in my case is every bit as egregious as what they did to General Flynn, but it's under a protective seal, so I can't discuss it. Jonathan Kravis filed a motion with the court saying that the government had additional information proving that the Russians hacked the DNC. Of course, he didn't provide any of it. That's because it doesn't exist. It was a fraud upon the court. In any event, the trial was a Soviet-style show trial. I was basically not allowed to defend myself. I was not allowed to defend myself outside the courtroom or in the media. I had a jury that had not a single Republican, not a single military veteran, not a single Roman Catholic, not a single African-American male, not a single union member, not a single person with just a high school education, no blue-collar workers. But I did have three veterans of the Clinton and Obama administration. I did have three attorneys. I did have a Democrat woman who ran for Congress. After I was found guilty on all counts, which was not surprising under the circumstances.
So you expected that?
Yeah, there was no question. No Republican or Trump supporter can get a fair trial in the District of Columbia, particularly when they limit the arguments you can make at trial.
Right.
Additionally, we learned that the jury forewoman, a Democrat from Tennessee, her name is Tomika Hart. She outed herself on CNN, so I'm not revealing her name. She actually tweeted and on Twitter and Facebook attacking me by name on the day I was arrested and subsequently, as well as consistently attacking Donald Trump.
You mean prior to the trial?
2019, the year before the trial. She misled the court during jury selection about this. In fact, she told the judge she didn't know who Roger Stone was. The U.S. Supreme Court guarantees every defendant an impartial and indifferent jury. This woman was in the tank from the beginning. Now, it is not enough under the law to just say she was a Democrat activist, or that she hated Donald Trump, although I think that should be disqualifying. But in this case, she attacked me personally. When the judge said, well, that was your lawyer's responsibility to learn that, it was impossible to learn that because your social media platforms were on private settings during the trial.
Right, and unless you're a friend or a member, you're not going to see it.
After the trial, she took down her Facebook page. What she would normally do is take Facebook links and post them on Twitter. She had a Facebook page since 2008. She deleted it and opened a new one. When we asked the judge in a hearing for the right to subpoena the deleted material from Facebook, it was denied.
And is this the reason why you sought a new trial over that juror?
Yes, we made a motion for a new trial. Every legal expert from Jonathan Turley on the left, Judge Andrew Napolitano, Alan Dershowitz said it was a very simple case. The judge ruled that we had not proved the juror's bias. I should mention, by the way, I filed my notice of appeal in this case because the misconduct of the prosecutors and the rulings of this judge and the misconduct of these jurors give me a very, very strong grounds for appeal. This was a lynching. And then when I went to be sentenced, the judge said there was nothing phony about the Mueller investigation. Really? How come there's a special counsel about to indict those who started it? She also said Roger Stone was convicted of covering up for Donald Trump. That was not one of the charges, and that was unproven.
Jeez.
She attacked my belligerence, which is interesting because I never testified. So where was I belligerent? Outside the courtroom? Judges aren't supposed to be paying attention to what happens outside the courtroom. Now, this was a kangaroo court start to finish, and I refused to roll over on Donald Trump, which is the real reason why I was prosecuted. The most classic tactic they use is to destroy you financially. I mean, people need to recognize I lost my home, my savings, my car, my insurance, my ability to make a living, because I make a living by reading, by writing and speaking, but I was under a gag order. And literally, I raised $2.2 million from 65,000 great Americans who contributed to my legal defense fund. And I spent it all in the initial trial. I now have to raise money for the appeal. I've been very candid about the fact that while I have not formally applied for a pardon, which is not necessary, and my lawyers have had no discussions with anybody at the White House, or in the administration about a pardon.
Do you have to apply for it, or can the president just do it on his own?
The president can just unilaterally do it. And I've been very candid, George. I pray for one every day.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
It's the only way I will get justice in this case.
And I don't think, Roger, and I've been thinking about this since you were convicted, that I don't think your particular case would hurt his political career if he pardons you at all. Because to me,
I think the exact opposite would be true. If he does not, as an act of mercy and justice, either commute my sentence or pardon me, I think a lot of his strongest supporters will be very disappointed.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I mean, the people who normally would have voted for him, if he pardons you, I don't think they're going to blame him. They're going to say, good decision. You got Roger off. Good for you.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I go to trial. Rick Gates, Paul Manafort's partner, who was convicted of the same crimes that Manafort is doing 7 years for, testifies that he overheard a conversation between Donald Trump and I in a car riding to LaGuardia Airport. He says there are two Secret Service agents in the car, and even though he's all the way back in the third seat and Trump is in the front right seat, he sees my name pop up on Trump's cell phone. The government never produces the two Secret Service agents to corroborate this lie. We have a convicted liar who was allowed to walk out on not paying millions of dollars worth of taxes. The government produces no corroboration, no phone bill, and Donald Trump himself denied this in writing to Robert Mueller. I deny it. The timing of it, early August, doesn't even make sense. But Mr. Gates, in return for his lies, got a 45-day sentence.
What do you think go ahead, Raj. Go ahead.
Steve Bannon testified that he and I spoke regularly about WikiLeaks. But now, today, it was announced that Steve Bannon's testimony and mine and every witness before the House Intelligence Committee will soon be released. I'll be very anxious to see whether what Steve told the committee under oath is different than what he said on the stand, because he and I never discussed WikiLeaks, although according to him, we discussed it in every conversation, and that I was viewed in the campaign as the access point to WikiLeaks, which would be news to me.
There was a story that came out of the Jerusalem Post just a few days ago that basically said Israel felt that they had some information on Hillary that they wanted to get to you or your associates. Again, what's wrong with that? If you're in a political campaign and somebody has some information, can't you get that?
Well, I mean, I think it is perfectly legal. But let's be clear. The two-party duopoly that run this country into the ground was desperate to get rid of a president they can't control. What Donald Trump has been able to do in 3 years, it boggles the mind. In other words, we were told that the manufacturing jobs would never come back, that America's greatest days were behind us, and we had to accept globalism. And Trump simply refused because he believes in American exceptionalism, because he believes that America is a special place. And yes, cutting taxes and regulation creates jobs. He brought us the lowest unemployment rates in our history. He brought us the fastest wage growth in our history. The entire Russian collusion narrative was a hoax to attempt to remove him. When that failed, they ginned up the Ukrainian hoax. That was a fraud as well. And I have concerns about coronavirus.
I was just going to ask you about that. What do you think about that?
I am not a scientist. I do know people. My son is a police officer. I know people on the force who have died of it. It is clearly a serious virus. But it did have the effect of destroying our economy. And some people, like Bill Gates, have exploited it in their campaign for mandatory vaccinations and some kind of tracking system. I don't care whether it's a bracelet or an armband or a microchip. I'm against it. And I'm opposed to mandatory vaccinations. But they have destroyed the strongest economy we've ever had. The good news is,
in 2 months,
Donald Trump knew how to do it once. Believe me, he knows how to do it again.
Raj, we're going to take a quick break. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about this case. I want to get your take on the 40 months that they have given you and get your take on that. And we'll take some phone calls with our listeners as well. Roger Stone's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com, as well as his Twitter link. And a couple of his books include Stone's Rules, Jeb and the Bush Crime Family as well. We will be back in a moment with political consultant Roger Stone right here on Coast to Coast AM.